We're in Job 29. It's now our fifth study in the book of Job. I've pointed out several times that it has been quite popular to assume that this book about loss answers the question, why? Why does God let suffering happen to believers? But that is the one question that keeps getting asked that never gets answered. Instead, when God finally meets Job, he basically asks him about 100 questions that all boil down to one question, and that is, Job, how awesome do you think I am? The question, the big question we need to ask in our suffering is, how awesome is God? How deeply do I fear God, reverence God? That's the big question the whole book focuses on. The account of Job, of course, is tragic. Job lived in the time of the patriarchs, probably around 2000 BC, maybe 1800 BC. He's a godly man who is incredibly blessed by God. He's blessed in his business. He's one of the wealthiest men alive. He's blessed in his family. He's got 10 children. Job delights in God. And yet, one of God's fallen angels, Satan, approaches the throne of God and accuses Job of loving God only for what he gets from God. So, God allows Satan to take away all the blessings, including the loss of his property and the loss of his children, even the loss of his health, take everything away to prove to Satan and the world and the unseen world that God is worth loving simply for who he is, not for anything we get out of him. After Job's catastrophic losses, and after he keeps on committing himself to God in those times of loss, three friends come to sit with him in silence for a week. And then they listen to him pour out his griefs. We can't imagine how low Job must be. And then these three friends begin to offer him counsel. And over half of this book, which we surveyed a few weeks back, over half of the book just records the back and forth dialogue with Job and his three friends. And essentially the three friends keep telling him, you must have done something to deserve this. Because God doesn't just let bad things happen to good people. And Job keeps responding, basically saying, but there's no sin in my life. I mean, there's no explanation. I have no clue why all this is happening to me. I wish, actually, he goes on to say, I could stand before God. And I could go head to head with God. And I could be proved innocent. I could be vindicated. It could be demonstrated in court with God, that I don't deserve any of this. That's where we left the story off in chapter 27. Today we study chapters 29 and 30 to 31, 29, 30, 31. We did one message on the heart of the book, which is chapter 28, which is where Job has this moment of calm and says life is simply about fearing God. And that's the most valuable thing in life. We study today three chapters, Job 29, 30, and 31, and these are Job's final words. The last statement of chapter 31 says, the words of Job are ended. Maybe a more colloquial way of saying that is, I rest my case. These are, as one commentator puts it, Job's concluding arguments. It's as if he's in a courtroom and he's saying, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. I've got nothing more to say. That's chapters 29, 30, and 31. We're going to take a few minutes to read these chapters together. And then we're going to state the main point pretty quickly and go for four ways they apply. In Job 29, Job basically says, I long for the way things used to be. I long for how life used to be. Look with me at Job 29:2. Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. As I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was on my tent, when the Almighty was still with me, when my children were all around me. Job's basically saying, I wish my life was like it used to be. Back then, it was like God was my friend. It's like, that's when I felt the presence of God. That's when I experienced the blessing of God. In verses 7 to 17, then, he remembers when he used to be so well respected by everyone in the city. He had an impeccable reputation for being just and being generous. He remembers, according to verse 18, very soberly, how he felt back then. He used to think to himself, I'm going to die in my nest. That's a way of saying, with all my children around me. And I'll multiply my days as the sand. In other words, he just remembers how he used to think in those times when he just felt the blessing of God. I'm certain I'm going to live a long life, and I'm going to die with my children around me. He concludes the chapter, chapter 29, in verses 21 and followings, just remembering how people used to appreciate him for the counsel, the wise counsel he would give, and the warm comfort that he would provide. So chapter 29 is a lament. Job basically saying, oh, how good my life used to be. By contrast, chapter 30 then, he's going to say, but my life right now is awful. In the first 8 verses of chapter 30, he says in essence, even though I used to be so well respected, today I'm mocked. I'm mocked even by the worst of fools. He admits in verse 10 that the worst of society, those who are lazy and willfully homeless, or those who are socially obnoxious, so obnoxious that they can't get along with anyone or even live in the same house with anyone. He's describing what has been talked about in the past as like the street vermin, the total willful down and outers. He says, they abhor me, verse 10, chapter 30, verse 10. They keep aloof from me. They don't hesitate to spit at the sight of me because God, according to verse 11, has humbled me. In other words, you can imagine Job walking through the worst parts of town. And this man who used to be so well respected has these wicked people looking at him saying, puh, look at you, big man. He used to be the highest in society. Now he's mocked by the lowest. He continues to describe his pain in verse 16. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. I'm broken. I'm depressed. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws at me takes no rest. I can't sleep because my pain never goes to sleep. Verse 18, with great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me in the mire. I've become like dust and ashes. The picture is, it's like God has grabbed my garments, pulled me up, and just thrown me in the mud. And look what he says in verse 20. I cry to you, God, for help, and yet you don't answer me. I stand, and you just stare there and look at me. You've turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind or into the violent winds. You make me ride on it. You toss me around in the roar of the storm. I know that you're going to bring me to death and to the house appointed for all the living. He basically says, I now know that God, for some reason I don't know, has turned his back on me. And he's just delighting to torture me, and I'm going to continue in this until I die. In the final verses of chapter 30, Job implies that he actually treated others who were suffering better than God is treating him. Look at verse 25. He says, basically, didn't I weep for those who were in hard times, those who were in need? Yet when in my need, I looked for help, I looked for light. It's like God slammed the door in my face, and he just left me there in the dark. In chapter 30, Job continues his lament. So he's basically just describing how awful his life is at present. In chapter 31 is where he rests his case. He says, I did nothing to deserve this. He basically keeps going through saying, if I've been wicked, I deserve trials. But I've not been wicked. I don't deserve this. He wraps up his concluding arguments with self-examination. The first words of chapter 31 are the famous words, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? So Job begins to evaluate his life for sin, starting with this question, have I gazed immorally at a woman? Let me just take a little aside. It's on the basis of this verse that the accountability software company Covenant Eyes gets its name. Greg and I both have been Covenant Eyes users for years. I've been a user for at least 10 years. Because we do not want immoral lust, which traps, some statistics say, 70% of guys our age every single week. We do not want it to be a part of our lives. But there, verses 1 and 2 is where Job begins his self-examination. And throughout the chapter, he basically evaluates his life by the Ten Commandments. He asks, have I committed adultery, either in desire or behavior? He says, if I did, then I'd expect God to bring this calamity on me. In verses 5 through 8, he's going to say, have I been deceptive? He says, basically, have I cheated anyone in my business dealings in order to make more money? If so, look at verse 8. He says, then let me sow and another reap. In other words, let all of my goods go to someone else if I've been deceptive in business. Verses 13 to 15, he basically says, have I mistreated anyone under my roof, any of my employees? He's basically saying, have I done any violence, any harm to people under my roof? In verse 15, Job knows that every single human being is made by God and therefore has precious dignity and is of equal value to everyone else. Don't ever let anyone tell you that this concept that all people are created equal began with the American Declaration of Independence. No, this man understood these foundational principles in 1800 BC. Job knows that every single human is precious. And even though he might be a very wealthy landowner, every single employee in his household is of equal value, regardless of their wealth or social status. And he says again, if I've been unjust, then all these trials are a right verdict from my judge. In verses 16 through 23, he asks, have I failed to love my neighbors? Especially, he works through the poor around him, the widows nearby, the orphans around him. And in verses 22 and 23, he basically says, if I've ignored their needs, then I deserve all of this terrifying calamity from God. Again, he's just outlining what a godly life looks like, what we were created to live like. He says, have I become covetous in verses 24 to 28? Have I lived with money as my God? Or have I put my trust in money or started to worship false gods in order to make more money? If I've done this, then God should punish me. One of the final things he considers is in verses 29 to 34. Have I cursed others in my heart or with my mouth? Have I rejoiced when people I didn't like got what they had coming to them? Have I desired their downfall? Notice the beginning of verse 35, he abruptly ends his self-examination. And he just cries out, oh, that I had a judge to hear my case. He says, here's my signature. Actually, some commentators say Job seems to be signing his name to a legal document declaring his innocence. My case is rested. I'm innocent. Job does not know what he's done to deserve this. That's why he ends saying, let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. If I could just know what I've done. As far as I can see, I've done nothing to deserve this suffering. Some people read these chapters, chapters 29, 30, and 31, and they think Job is just having a pity party. He's given into self-pity. He's just wallowing in his miserable circumstances, remembering the good old days. Others read these chapters and they think Job is arrogant. What a self-righteous man. Both of these, however, are wrong. He is neither giving in to self-pity, nor is he proclaiming anything in self-righteousness. He is lamenting, but he's not wallowing in self-pity. Dwayne Garrett describes best the emotion of these chapters. He says they express his disorientation. Job understands nothing of what has happened to him, and this is tormenting him. Those are the words of Dwayne Garrett. And this is often the experience of people who are grieving loss. If you talk with someone who has recently lost a spouse or been paralyzed, even if you talk to a senior adult whose kids have taken away the keys, loss leaves people with this disorientation, this disillusionment. They don't know what happened to them. They struggle to know who they are anymore. Loss leaves people disoriented. That is the emotion that you get here. It's no pity party. This is lament. And this isn't some claim to self-righteousness. Job has said numerous times throughout the book that he's in desperate need of God's forgiveness. He openly confesses his sin and turns from it whenever God reveals it to him. That's chapters 40 and 42. And Job says explicitly, chapter 31, verse 33, that he has not hidden his sins like others do. But instead, he's openly dealt with his sins and opened up about his sins. So Job's not declaring any kind of self-righteousness here. The critical thing we must remember is that, according to God in chapters 1 and 2, Job had done nothing to deserve this. In other words, as Job looks at his life, as he examines himself, truly, there's nothing he's done to deserve this. The main point of Job 29, 30, and 31 is, in the words of Job, I've done nothing to deserve my trials, but stated as a principle for all of us, your suffering should lead you to examine yourself for sin. But your suffering may have nothing to do with your sin. And I think there are four critical ways to apply this to our lives. The first is, prepare yourself for the disillusionment of suffering. Critical applications of these three chapters. Prepare yourself for the disillusionment of suffering. This book of the Bible so powerfully teaches that no amount of commitment to God can guarantee an easy life. It runs contrary to the most popular preachers on TV in our day. Give to God. Have faith in God. And life will go well for you. It'll go easy for you. You'll have the things that you want. You'll be fulfilled. That is hogwash. This book says hogwash over all the TV screens in which you have these health, wealth, prosperity preachers. This book teaches the exact opposite, along with the whole Bible, right? The whole Bible teaches very often the individuals most committed to God experience some of the worst sufferings. If you're sitting here this morning thinking something like this, I'm just enjoying the blessing of God right now. I know that God is with me. I know that God is for me. So much is just going so well for me right now in my life. If that's you, know that as you keep walking with the Lord, pretty certainly there are going to be times when you don't feel so strong. There may be times when you feel like Job in chapter 29, when you're basically saying, God, have you turned against me? It's like you used to be my friend. There may be times coming for you, Christian, in the will of God, that you're going to look back and you're going to say, oh, if only I felt that God was with me and felt that God was for me like He did back then. That kind of experience happens to the most godly people. So prepare yourself for it. I'm not trying to predict anything. I'm not trying to be a prophet. I'm definitely not trying to say, get scared. You have nothing to fear. Peter says this constantly in a letter about suffering. Don't fear, don't fear, don't fear. You have nothing to fear, Christian. Just know that you could find yourself in a trial, completely disillusioned. It's like you can't see up from down. You feel like God has abandoned you. You feel like, to use Job's words again, it's almost like God has started using you for target practice. God, have you turned against me? Prepare yourself. This chapter tells us to prepare ourselves. If such a moment comes, God will be no farther from you then than He is today. And God will be no more against you then than He was when you were His enemy and He determined to give His one and only Son for you. Second application. Know well what the Bible teaches about suffering and sin, the relationship between suffering and sin. The Bible does teach that all suffering is generally related to sin. In other words, if Adam had never disobeyed, there would be no sin, suffering, pain, death, tears in the world. But that doesn't mean that every episode of suffering that you experience is due to some specific sin you've committed. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. You've got to get this down. Suffering generally is related to the curse on the world that will be lifted at the return of Jesus. But specific incidents of suffering may or may not be related to sin in your life. Let me start with the it may be related to sin side of things. So first, God often, if you think back to the book of Numbers, He often afflicted Israel with suffering for their sin of complaining. Right? It was like sin committed, infliction of trial, directly related. Or, God gave an unbeliever, like Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, over to some kind of temporary psychological insanity. Some people say boanthropy, for the specific sin of arrogance, pride. Or God put a believer like David through years of family trials that were a consequence of his horrific adultery. God put a believer like Jonah into a storm because of his direct rebellion against the command of God. God sometimes lets affliction hit Christians who eat at the Lord's table with hatred of other believers in their hearts. That's 1 Corinthians 11, right? Sickness can be related, directly related to sin. But it may not be. Okay, so I just gave like 5 examples of ways that it may be directly connected. It may not be. The Bible offers many examples of suffering that's not directly connected to personal sin. So, God allowed a believer like Joseph, a godly man, young man like Joseph, to suffer for years at the hands of his brothers and for years in Egypt. Not for any sin in Joseph's life, but for the good plan that God had to rescue His people. Or God allowed Naaman, an unbeliever, to suffer leprosy, not for any sin that Naaman had committed, not for any specific sin in his life. And interestingly, eventually, this brought Naaman to the Lord. in God's plan and not for any sin that they had committed, the prophet Ezekiel suffered the loss of his wife because God was trying more profoundly to draw Israel to himself through Ezekiel's sufferings. Daniel suffers in the lion's den. Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, suffers for decades with infertility so that God's glory would be more greatly highlighted in her later life. Paul suffered with a thorn in the flesh so that God's grace would be magnified. Do you get the idea? I haven't even talked about the blind man whom the disciples came and said, "So who sinned, this man or his family?" No, no one sinned. He was made this way so that the works of God might be magnified in his life. So, Christian, if you're going to prepare well for suffering, point number one, you have to know what the Bible teaches about it, and you have to know it well. Like, this has to be like 1 + 1 = 2 in our Christian life, because when disillusionment happens, you need 1 + 1 = 2 kind of simple things. Some suffering is the direct result of sin. Some is not. Third, in times of trial, take time to examine yourself for sin. Job models the way Christians should examine themselves. He models a general use of the Ten Commandments, which spell out what love for God looks like and what love for others looks like. We were made. We exist. The reason we breathe is to love God and others. So Job uses these Ten Commands, and he basically looks at his life with certain searchlights, spotlights on the property of his life, saying, how am I doing in purity? How am I doing in honesty? How am I doing in terms of compassion or contentment? Job models for us that a godly response to suffering is a degree of self-examination. And this, too, is true in both Old and New Testaments. Let me point you to one crucial passage in the New Testament. It's James 5, verses 14, 15, and 16. If you're a member of Tri-County Bible Church and you are dealing with chronic illness, James commands you to ask the elders of the church to come anoint you with oil and pray over you. If you ask the elders to come and gather around you, we will. And part of what James envisions in that sacred ceremony of prayer is a time of group confession of sins. So, if the elders come to your house, and I always prepare people when we come, what is it going to be like? I say, notice that James says, confess your sins to one another. I say, we're going to ask a question like, are there any sins to confess? Any sins that God is putting his finger on in your life? And this is not something that just the sufferer does, but all of the elders along with the sufferer do. We use it as a time of self-examination. Is God putting his finger on any sin in our lives? So if you're suffering, you should take time to examine yourself. Use the Ten Commandments. Or maybe use Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus preaches the Ten Commandments, or several of them. Or simply use Job 31 as an opportunity for self-examination in your suffering. How does the self-examination of Job strike you? I'm specifically asking non-Christians this. Like, he goes through his life and he looks at issues like contentment, issues like whether he ignored needy people around him, issues like, has he looked with immoral desire at a woman? Honesty. Has he been honest, totally above board in his business dealings? And has he ever delighted when one of the people that he doesn't like very much fell? These kind of sins that come up, like mental purity, zero deception, no sex outside of marriage, no cheating, no covetousness, no vengefulness. How do you think you're going to do before a judge who bases his judgment on those kind of standards? When your whole life, your thoughts, your words, your actions, when it's just laid naked before God, how are you going to stand? The Bible says that there's one way. one sacrifice for your sins. It's what Jesus did when he died on Calvary. You need to look at that judgment day as a tornado that you're walking right into the middle of. And the only hope that you have is that there's some kind of underground bunker, some kind of cellar deep below the surface that you can hide in as the storm of judgment passes over. The only bunker you can run to as you anticipate judgment is committing your life totally to Jesus. Run to Jesus. Hide in Jesus. He's our only hope. There's going to be no human who stands before God's judgment seat on their own two feet and says, "I earned a relationship with you, God." If we're honest with ourselves, we've fallen constantly. And we really deserve nothing but judgment. Fourth and finally, in times of blessing, don't let yourself get lax in godliness. He's exemplary in this time of self-examination, but I think even more compelling for me is the way Job lived with a clean conscience during his times of prosperity. Isn't it so true that in our prosperity, we kind of get lazy in our relationship with God? We kind of just start coasting. We sing a song about this, don't we? "Oft times when life seems gentle and blessings flood my way, I turn my gaze away from you and soon forget to pray." For many of God's people, trials bring us back to God. But it shouldn't be like that. So what I invite you to do right now, imagine a trial coming on you right now. What if you're in an accident today? What if you get a cancer diagnosis tomorrow? What if you experience the sudden death of a loved one? Go there right now in your mind. Would there be some laxness in your life that God would immediately put his finger on and say, "You've been letting this go way too long"? Would there be some sin that you've been ignoring that God would immediately bring to your conscience and say, "Deal with this"? Then I would say, deal with it right now. Don't let time go on. Don't let a trial bring this out. And I'm not even saying, like, do it so that you won't go through a trial. Like, you and I exist to love God and others. This is why we breathe. Jesus saved us so that we would peculiarly belong to him and him alone, and so that we would manifest his character in our lives. Is there something about Jesus' character that's not being manifested in your life? Address it so that you can live for what life's all about. Don't wait for suffering. Now, if you are in suffering right now, there may be someone in here, and you just know God has put his finger on one issue in your life, and your suffering is like a red light saying, deal with that problem, deal with that problem, deal with that problem. Admit it, repent of it, move on. Don't wallow there. Live in prosperity with the same focus on God like you would in adversity. Job's burden in these chapters is basically, God, I did nothing to deserve this. And he was right. He hadn't done anything to deserve this. This is our closing meditation as we go right to the Lord's Supper. Don't forget the story. Satan had accused Job of living for God only for God's blessings. And even more, Satan had accused God of not being worth serving. At this moment of greatest weakness in Job's life, Job was not turning away from God. Satan had said, take his blessings, take his business, take his kids, take his health. He will turn on you, God. He will curse you. Job is at the lowest of lows here. He has no idea why what's happening is happening. And instead of turning from God, he keeps on turning to God. He's continuing to cry to God. He's continuing to look to God. And don't miss it. He's continuing to honor God. In these cries, he's taking them to God. Derek Thomas put it so powerfully. God had set up Job as his champion against Satan. And though the champion is bleeding from the scars of battle, he's winning. You're looking at Job, who can't understand a thing about why he's suffering like he is. And you're looking at a man of genuine, enduring, tested faith, and he's magnifying God's worth. I love it. And in this darkness, in this disillusionment, Job is really foreshadowing the ultimate champion, isn't he? In the middle of the ultimate champion's darkness, which he was enduring for no fault of his own, he shouted, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That was the weak cry of dereliction, as it's called. Jesus is crying out to God, "Why have you abandoned me?" And at that lowest and darkest of moments, Jesus is powerfully accomplishing eternal salvation for all who would flee to him. When he was weakest, he was strongest. He was dying for us and for an example for us. And believer, just know that when you're suffering and you do not understand why, in your greatest moment of weakness, you're magnifying God the most. Keep turning to him. Keep crying out to him. And you will keep honoring him, even though you don't understand.